Our web stream is made possible by donations from our listeners. Please go to WPKN.org to make a contribution or become a member of the WPKN community.
Tuesday, partly sunny, highs in the mid-60s. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy, with lows in the upper 40s. Wednesday shapes up like this. Partly sunny, highs in the mid-60s. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy with lows in the mid-40s. Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-60s. You know, I would take Wednesday or Thursday off. That's what I would do. Thursday night looks like this. Partly cloudy with lows in the upper 40s. Wind chill values, however, this is Thursday night, as low as 30 below in the evening. Friday, to round out the week, partly sunny in the morning, then mostly cloudy with a chance of rain in the afternoon. Highs around 60, chance of rains of only about 30%. And Friday night, if you're heading out, mostly cloudy, rain likely, mainly after midnight, lows around 50. Chance of rain's about 60%. You know how that all works. I'm Patrick O'Sullivan, and this ends another edition of Jazz Variations. I leave you with Gold Company in the background. And So Am I, the name of the track, courtesy of Western Michigan University. Gold Company. I'll check in with Pete just for one last time, and Scott Harris is up in just a few seconds. Pete, how is everything back there?
Well, pretty quiet right now, but you can still give us a call, 203-384-9756, and we're going to take a couple last pledges here. There won't be any fundraising during Scott's program, so this would be a good time to show your support for Scott's Counterpoint program, as well as Patrick O'Sullivan's very cool show. So, yeah, thanks, Patrick. It's great to hear you on the air, as always.
Thanks for helping me out there, Pete. And Scott Harris is next, and here is the White Rose Political Calendar. Bye-bye.
Welcome to this week's edition of the White Rose Political Calendar. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the horrifying agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers its weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggles for political, social, economic, and environmental justice. Here are this week's listings. On Wednesday, October 21st, a poultry flock management workshop will be held from 7 to 9 p.m. at the auditorium of Edgewood School, 737 Edgewood Avenue in New Haven. Small flock owners will learn about breeds, housing, nutrition, health, and other important topics. Poultry specialist Dr. Michael J. Dare will present the workshop. The event is free and open to the public, sponsored by the University of Connecticut Extension Service and hosted by Edgewood School and the New Haven Board of Aldermen. This workshop aims to provide information to prospective hen keepers following the passage of a new law by the Board of Aldermen allowing small flocks of backyard hens and seeks to encourage responsible hen keeping in New Haven. On October 23rd and 24th, in observation of Domestic Violence Awareness Month, Pink and Blue Arts for Violence Prevention Project will be presenting Testify, Real Stories, Real People at 7:30 p.m. at Bregamos Theater, 315 Peck Street in New Haven. Spanning a spectrum of generations and their perceptions of each other, Testify portrays the shared experience, response, resistance, and victory of people affected by and concerned with similar issues, including violence, oppression, and poverty. Written by Del Mance, Rosmo, Moses, and directed by Halima Flynn. Sponsored by the Department of Cultural Affairs, the City of New Haven, and Pink and Blue Arts for Violence Prevention Project in conjunction with Fire Dragon Productions. For more information, visit fdponstage.com. That's fdponstage.com. On Saturday, October 24th, Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and Squeaky Wheel Productions will present a public forum and film screening, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What Can Be Done About It, with University of Massachusetts Economics Professor Emeritus Richard D. Wolfe. Hear analysis and solutions Michael Moore doesn't cover in his new film, Capitalism, A Love Story. It's from 2 to 4:30 p.m. with a reception to follow at the Unitarian Society of New Haven, 700 Hartford Turnpike in Hamden, Connecticut. For more information and to reserve tickets, call 203-268-8446. That's 203-268-8446. Also on Saturday, October 24th, join a global movement to solve the climate crisis. Come to the New Haven Green from 3 to 5 p.m. to send a clear message to world leaders at the upcoming climate conference in Copenhagen that the planet needs to reduce carbon dioxide to 350 parts per million in order to avoid catastrophic climate change. Actions are happening in 162 countries. Groups will be tabling on the green, and there'll be activities for children. At 3:50 p.m., we'll build a human numeral 350 and take an aerial photo. Visit 350.org/New Haven for more information. Then from 7 to 9 p.m. that evening, come to the Transition Roadshow at the Quaker Meeting House, 225 East Grand Avenue, New Haven. The program covers problems like peak oil, climate change, economic meltdown, and solutions like creating sustainable community on a human scale. There will be entertainment, reflection, inspiration, and dynamic participation all in one show. On Saturday, October 24th, from 6 to 10 p.m., it's a fundraiser for School of the Americas Watch, Long Island, and a tribute to Dennis Erlob, recent co-chair of South Country Peace Group, to honor his work with many Long Island peace and social justice groups. It's at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bellport, 51 Brown Lane. All monies raised will help send a local activist to Fort Benning, Georgia, for this year's annual protest to close the School of the Americas, now known as WINSEC, the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Jax Waterfall and Michael Bonte will perform. Call 631-875-8647 for more information. That's 631-875-8647. To include your group's upcoming events in the listings of the White Rose political calendar, send information about national, regional, and local events 2 weeks in advance when possible to whiterosewpkn@gmail.com. That's whiterosewpkn@gmail.com. This week's calendar was produced by Melinda Tuhus.
This is WPKM Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. We hope you'll stay tuned next for Counterpoint, coming right up.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I am a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serve its own needs. Dummy serve your own needs. Feed it up and oxygen. The fury's breathing down your neck. Keep my team reporters, Babble Trump, Kevin Kraft, look at that, no plane, fine, then, uh-oh, overflow, population common, but what it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world, just don't need, listen to your heartbeat, dummy, with the rancher and the rabbit and the right, right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, right, my feeling, pretty sight,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world. Cotton board, tower, slice and burn, return. Listen to yourself, churn. Lock it in, uniform and book, burning blood. Ready in every motor, best of late. Automotive, center rate. Light a candle, light a motor. Step down, step down. Watch your heel, crush, crush. Uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear. Turn them in, a turn them in, a turn them in, a fly. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Mondays between 8 and 10 p.m. We're glad you could be with us here tonight on the show. We've got a lot in store for you. In just a little bit, we're going to be speaking with economics professor Richard Wolff, author of the book and creator of the film Capitalism Hits the Fan. We'll be talking about the economic collapse, long-term solutions, and we'll be previewing an event coming up this Saturday in Hamden, Connecticut with Professor Wolff. A little later on tonight, we'll be hearing from Eleanor Schmiel, founder and president of the Feminist Majority and former president of the National Organization for Women. We're going to be looking at congressional debate on the health care reform issue and how the failures of the nation's current health care system particularly impacts women. And later on tonight, Harvey Wasserman will be here. He's an author and activist, and he's going to be telling us why he believes the climate change bill that's now moving through Congress is in part a shell game that promotes fossil fuels and new nuclear power plants. And he'll also be looking ahead to December's United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. And lastly tonight, we're going to be hearing from author Frank Schaefer, former right-wing activist and author of the book Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take It All or Almost All of It Back. He's going to describe his journey from being a religious right activist to what he sees himself now as, someone who's kind of in the middle and appalled at all the hateful and violence-promoting rhetoric that he sees coming out of the extreme right wing of this country. So that's an interesting discussion last tonight with Frank Schaefer. And just a word before we get to our first interview with Richard Wolff, and that is WPKN, as you know, is in the midst of its one-week fun drive here. And I just want to encourage you all to pledge what you can. The station is certainly in need of your dollars to survive, and in these hard economic times, as it is with your own household budget, you understand that cherished things can go under pretty quick if they're not paid attention to and not made a priority. So if this station as a font of information and news and culture and music that you don't get other places is important to you during this week, please pick up your phone and call us and make a pledge of whatever you can afford. But don't let it go by, because this station can slip into the great beyond if we are all not careful and all not really diligent in making the funds available for it to pay the bills to remain on these airwaves. So do call us and do pledge often in the next 5 days of this drive. I believe it goes right through this weekend. But do make it a point to pledge. We're not going to be doing the fun drive on this slot. It ends at 8 o'clock tonight. But we will be back on Wednesday afternoon with Between the Lines, and again Sunday to talk about particularly the home that public affairs programs like Between the Lines and this program, Counterpoint, have had on the station for many years. And again, we hope you will support it. We're going to go to Richard Wolff in just a moment, but here's a word about an upcoming event where Richard Wolff will be speaking in an event sponsored by the group I work with here at the station, Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and Squeaky Wheel Productions. So here you go.
To understand the American economy in the last 30 years amounts to this. Employers no longer raise the wages of their workers. Instead, they lent them the money, which he has to pay back with interest.
Renowned University of Massachusetts economics professor Richard Wolff is coming to the Unitarian Church in Hamden on Saturday, October 24th, where, using his film and recently published book, he'll present a revealing examination of the Wall Street schemes that triggered the economic collapse. Wolff's analysis differs sharply from most other explanations offered by economists and politicians, and expands on the message delivered in Michael Moore's new film, Capitalism, A Love Story. This public forum addressing the nation's worst economic downturn since the Great Depression is titled Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It, and will be held from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Saturday, October 24th at the Unitarian Church, 700 Hartford Turnpike, Hamden, Connecticut. Richard Wolff's talk and Q&A with the audience will be preceded by a screening of the film Capitalism Hits the Fan, based on Professor Wolff's recent lectures, and followed by a book signing and reception. Net proceeds from the event will benefit Squeaky Wheel Productions, nonprofit distributor of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, broadcast nationwide. Seating is limited, and advance reservations are recommended. For more information, directions, or to make reservations, call area code 203-268-8446 or visit us on the web at squeakywheel.net. That's Professor Richard Wolff discussing the global economic meltdown and what to do about it from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Saturday, October 24th at the Unitarian Church in Hamden. For more information and reservations, call 203-268-8446 or visit squeakywheel.net.
They say we're back on capital. It fails us now. Come in, let us be the time.
And we have Professor Richard Wolff with us tonight here on Counterpoint. Professor Wolff is a Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a visiting professor currently at the New School University's Graduate Program in International Affairs. His latest book, of the many he's written and co-authored over the years, is titled Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. Richard Wolff's recent lectures were the subject of a video documentary released earlier this year, also titled Capitalism Hits the Fan. Professor Wolff, who served as a consultant to Michael Moore's new movie, Capitalism, A Love Story, as you just heard in the announcement, will be speaking at a screening of his film and a talk this Saturday from 2 to 4:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Church in Hamden, Connecticut. Richard Wolff, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I wonder if we would just begin here by talking about the core message of your book and film. Beyond the very important critique of capitalism as a system that has failed us, not just now, but certainly in the past. But you talk more recently in history where corporate America made a decision in the 1970s to cut back on workers' wages. And this, of course, contributed to the current economic collapse. I wondered, in your very inimitable way of making economics the dismal science it's often referred to, you have an excellent way of cutting through all the rhetoric and ununderstandable lingo that economists often use to make it extremely clear to us lay people. And I thank you for that. That's the great part about your work. But do tell us what you think the connection is between the decline in wages and what we've seen transpire over the past year.
Okay, and thank you for the kind words. I always tell folks that one of the reasons I went into economics was I had the same reaction you did sitting there in the classes and hearing this stuff, and I simply thought to myself, anything as exciting as understanding how human beings go about producing and distributing the goods and services they need, that's interesting and that's exciting, and I'm just not going to allow these teachers to make it so technical and so dull that everybody who isn't an engineer leaves the room. Anyway, let me try to summarize that argument. And I'll begin by making a slight amendment to what you said. It's not so much that employers across America did something in the 1970s that they hadn't thought about and would have liked to do earlier. It's that for the previous 100 years, from 1870 to 1970, it hadn't been possible. That is, employers were constantly facing labor shortages. There weren't enough people working. Too many of the people who were working, if they got dissatisfied with their jobs, pulled up stakes, traveled west, and started a new life, got a piece of land, or whatever. And it was a perpetual kind of shortage of labor that meant that employers were competing for workers, and so they had to raise wages. And for 100 years, 1870 to 1970, American workers got the benefit. Their wages rose year in, year out. It was amazing. Probably no other country in the world ever delivered for a century a regularly rising standard of living for its workers. And as a result, millions of immigrants came here because they wanted to participate
in something happening here that they were pretty sure wasn't going to happen in their own country, and they were mostly right. Employers didn't want to do that. They really had no choice. What happened in the 1970s was that conditions in the world of work changed, and so employers were able to do what they would have liked to do earlier but hadn't been able to. Namely, they didn't need to raise wages anymore. There were just too few jobs relative to the number of people looking for jobs, and the result was that the century of wage increases came to an end. And really what has happened in the last 30 years and building up to the crisis we're in now, which is the worst crisis of capitalism in our lifetimes, is a result of how workers on the one hand and employers on the other reacted to those changed conditions in the 1970s that led to the end of rising wages. And to make the story really as brief as I can, workers responded with a kind of shock, and they behaved the way shocked people do. They had come to expect that wages would rise, that each generation would live better than the one before, and that each set of parents could deliver an American dream of a better life to their children, and so on. So when the wages stopped rising, they couldn't count on their wages, on getting more for every hour of their work over time, to pay for this. And instead of saying, well, that's it, end of the American dream, we give up, they tried to solve the problem individually, even though it was a social problem and a social change. And so they did two things. They sent more members out of the house to do more hours of work. You know, if the wage per hour doesn't go up, well, one response is to do more hours. Adult men took on second and third jobs. Women, by the millions, left the home and the role of homemaker and mother and entered the world of paid work. Teenagers took part-time jobs, retired, and older folks went back to work. And we became a nation of real quasi-workaholics. Just to give you one idea, in 2009, the average number of hours worked per year by an American worker is 20% more than the average number of hours worked by a Swedish, German, French, or Italian worker, just as a comparison. It's extraordinary. And the other thing that American workers did when their wages didn't go up anymore was they tried to buy the American dream by borrowing more and more and more. And so we come now to this crisis, and we have a working class in America, the vast majority, that's physically exhausted from all the extra work it's been doing, more than workers in other countries, that's emotionally stressed because the women who had held the emotional life of families together at home are now just as tired as their husbands, just as in need of comfort as the husbands ever were, and yet so stressed and exhausted that they can't really provide it. And there's a reason why we have the highest divorce rate in the Western world and so on. The strains and stresses and tensions are enough to put the whole family into a kind of a perpetual crisis. And finally, we have families that are scared out of their minds, and appropriately so, by the level of debt they're carrying. Another little statistic. When the Great Depression of the 1930s began in 1929, the average level of debt of an American family was about a quarter of its annual income. In 2007, when the current crisis hit, the average level of debt of an American family was 130% of its annual income. It's a level of debt that no working class has ever had to carry before. So we come to a working class exhausted, stressed, and anxious about its debt. On the other side of the equation, the employers have had 30 years of as good as it gets for them. Over those 30 years, workers became in America ever more productive, working with computers more and more. The average worker produced more goods and services each year than the year before. That is, the workers delivered every year more produce, more output to their employer than the year before. But the great difference was the employer didn't have to pay them any more than before. So all of the increases in productivity, all of the extra output that workers were able to achieve went to the profits of their employer and didn't show up in rising wages. So the employers went on a kind of a binge. they started paying themselves spectacular salaries, the kinds of salaries and bonuses that are now in the news as Americans discover, 30 years late, what is being done with the money they generate and that accrues into the hands of employers. They used another part of that pool of money to make even more profits by moving production out of the United States and to countries around the world where they could get the work done even more cheaply than here. They used another part of the profits they made to kind of really enter the political arena. The last 30 years have been a spectacular process in which the overworked, overstressed American worker gets less and less involved in politics. Because he hasn't the time, he hasn't the energy, he hasn't got the spirit, he's too absorbed, and she is too, in making ends meet, in working out the tensions of the family, in getting by in a difficult environment. And the time and energy to follow politics isn't there. But at the same time, the employers, sitting on the rising profits that come from a rising productivity and flat wages, are able to throw ever more of this resource, this money, into politics. And if politics becomes a question of money, of paying for expensive TV ads, the employers, having good times over the last 30 years, were able to throw money just as the working class withdrew. And that moved American politics sharply to the right. And those of us who have watched that process and those who have bemoaned that process ought to understand that it isn't because Republicans are smarter or less smart than Democrats, and it isn't the fault of this or that presidential candidate or something like that. This shift in politics comes out, like so much of our society, from this basic change in the relationship between workers and capitalists. And when the 30 years was over, and capitalists had spun their financial networks around the world and had put the American working class into debt it couldn't sustain, it should have come as no surprise that sooner or later the overstressed, exhausted, and over-indebted workers would not be able to pay back these excessive loans, often pushed on them by aggressive banks. They would start to default, and then the whole elaborate house of cards built up over these 30 years would come crashing down. And I use this argument to show folks that we're in a very serious economic crisis. This is not a quick one, a short one. It will not do to get us back to where we were 2 or 3 years ago, because where we were 2 or 3 years ago was on an economic train speeding at high levels of velocity into a stone wall. And if we get back there these days with all this talk of quote-unquote recovery, we're going to be in very tough shape 1 or 2 years down the road, because we're not addressing these underlying economic problems. Sorry to take so long, but that's the basic argument.
Richard, I know you'll be expanding on that at the event this Saturday in Hamden. But I also, before you go, and we only have a few minutes left, I wanted to ask you about Michael Moore's new film, Capitalism Love Story. The film managed, in a big way, reaching a big audience, to break a nearly complete unofficial ban on critiquing capitalism. And as a consultant on this film, what do you think are the film's contributions to the public debate that we need to have right now on where our economic system goes from here? And that's a longer question than I know you could probably deal with in a couple of minutes, but what's your gut feeling about the effect this film will have?
I think it's enormous, while I do admit, and I have said this to many folks, I regret a little bit that Michael Moore doesn't acknowledge that human beings have been critical of capitalism for a long time, that human beings have tried both in theory and in practice to work with alternatives to capitalism, everything from cooperative enterprises to worker self-managed enterprises and many more, and I'm kind of sorry about that. Having said that, when he asked me to participate and to consult on the film, which I did, I jumped at the chance. I accepted with appreciation the invitation. And the reasons are really what you said, and I'll expand just briefly on it. We have had a taboo in the United States. We can't discuss our economic system. It's like the taboos that are attached to, I don't know, sex or other difficult topics in the past. And so we live in an economic system that has broken down twice in 75 years, the Great Depression of the 30s and now this again. Between those two, we had 12 business cycle downturns that threw millions of people out of work. And yet, an economic system with two major breakdowns in 75 years and 12 business cycles that disrupted millions of people's lives gets a free pass. It's an economic system about which we don't ask the most obvious question, which is, an economic system exists to serve the people who live with it. If that service provided by the economic system is not sufficiently reasonable, good, and positive, then human beings have the right to have a public discussion and debate that basically asks the question, can we do better? I'm not sure what the answer to that question is, and I'm not asking people to believe that there's necessarily a better system. But to refuse to discuss it is a kind of censorship of the human community's natural and appropriate desire to question the existing institutions and to make basic changes if they can be improved upon. And the importance of Michael Moore's film is, as you say, to break the unspoken taboo that it is possible to talk about our economic system, to call it by its proper name, capitalism, to ask whether it is consistent with our democratic values, and really much of Michael's film is to question that, to say basically that capitalism, in his view, is not consistent with democratic values. And that's an argument, and that argument ought to be engaged. People ought to take it seriously, and he's helping to produce the national conversation on that subject, which leaders from both the Republican and Democratic Party have now for half a century refused to do.
Well, Richard Wolff, we only got a minute or two left, but as we've spoken before, and I think it's generally acknowledged, we are living now in a very narrow window of opportunity to have very substantive discussions on fixing the structure of our economic system, as you do in this book and film, talking about alternatives, talking about the need really to have a very frank and honest discussion of the shortcomings of the capitalist system we live under all these decades here in this country. And I wonder if you just mention a few of the things that you will be touching on in an expanded discussion this coming Saturday at the Hamden, Connecticut event at the Unitarian Church.
Right.
That's this Saturday, October 24th, from 2 to 4:30.
Yes, let me briefly give a hint of some of the things I'm going to do on Saturday. I'm going to try to make suggestions that range from the well-known kinds of things that could be done, for which there are many historical precedents, to the more far-reaching things, which I will argue are necessary now because we have waited too long, in a sense. The first sort would be a program in which the government becomes an employer of last resort. This is something that Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s. He basically went on the radio back then, and he told the American people, we have too many millions of people unemployed. The private sector is unable or unwilling to provide them with jobs. Okay, if they won't, we will. And he then set the government out to be what he called the employer of last resort. And I would argue that since the last 2 years have seen the government be the lender of last resort, the bailer out of banks, insurance companies, and big corporations of last resort, the guarantor of credit of last resort, there really is no justification for not having helped the mass of people by being an employer. If the 15 million unemployed today could at least in large part be employed by the government, they'd earn a decent living, they'd take care of their families, they could pay off their mortgages and so avoid foreclosure. It would be a way to use past practice in the United States to make a difference. But much more far-reaching is the whole idea of changing the basic way our industries and enterprises work so we don't find ourselves 2, 4, 6 years out from now once again in this kind of recurring economic breakdown. And I think if we change the basic way we organize enterprises to break from the old capitalist way, we'll have a better chance of doing that, and I'll try to explain that on Saturday.
All right. Well, Professor Richard Wolff, looking forward to your appearance at the Unitarian Church in Hamden this Saturday, 2 to 4:30. We'll mention more of the details later. But again, thanks for spending a little time with us tonight and a preview of what you'll be telling our audience this Saturday. Appreciate all the work you've done here. We've been speaking with Professor of Economics Richard Wolff and talking about his latest book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. We'll have film screening. Will also be shown this Saturday, a documentary film based on Professor Wolff's recent lectures about the economic collapse. So Richard Wolff, we'll look forward to seeing you on Saturday, and thanks again for being here on WPKN.
And thank you very much. I salute WPKN for having provided one of the most remarkable and consistent openings up of the American mind that I know of, and it was a pleasure to listen to you for many, many years.
Oh, thank you, Richard. Appreciate it, and we'll talk to you on Saturday.
Okie doke. See you then.
All right. Bye-bye.
Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay.
Shop till you drop.
The American way.
Got free money, but you have to pay.
From the sea to the shining sea.
Got free money, but you have to pay.
Signing up for bankruptcy.
Got free money, but you have to pay.
Everyone's a card, they're blind like a crackhead. They send it in the mail, soon your house is for sale. MasterCard fees, push and a squeeze. You're pre-approved by Amex, a credit scam.
Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay.
Shop till you drop.
The American way. Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay.
Shop till you drop.
The American way. Got free money, but you have to pay.
Late fee, 505.
Got free money, but you have to pay.
I smell the work of a congressman.
Got free money, but you have to pay.
That card in the mail to make you feel comfy. Two jobs at Walmart won't pay the monthly. Mama, mama, did you come up short? The fine print, read all about it in court.
Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay.
Shop till you drop.
The American way. Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay.
Shop till you drop.
The American way. Got free money, but you have to pay.
So music from the film In Debt We Trust, all about the economic, or I should say the credit crisis in this country that certainly preceded the economic collapse, and that was a piece of music from an artist named Polarity. Free money, but you have to pay. And that follows our interview with Professor of Economics Richard Wolff, previewing his appearance in Hamden, Connecticut at the Unitarian Church there this Saturday, 2 to 4:30, talking about his book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown, and What to Do About It. Right now, I'm very happy to introduce Eleanor Schmiel. She is president of the Feminist Majority and two-time president of the National Organization for Women. For more than three decades, Eleanor Schmiel has been a leading activist on fighting for women's rights and human rights. And she's here tonight to talk to us about the health care debate in Congress. Eleanor, so happy you could be with us this evening.
That's great. I'm glad to be here.
Before we get started on some of the things that I know you are specifically working on regarding health care reform, I wanted to get your overview of this congressional fight for some meaningful changes in our healthcare system, which has certainly failed millions, tens of millions of people in this country. And as a recent Physicians for National Health Program reporter, I believe it was a Harvard University report, found there are more than 40,000 people that die every year directly attributable to them not having health care insurance. But do tell us what you think is happening in Congress as we just witnessed the Finance Committee vote in a proposed bill that does not include a public option.
Right. Well, I'm hopeful still that we do get a public option, and I think we have to fight for that. As you know, the Speaker has pretty much guaranteed it's coming out of the House with a public option, And it has already come out of the Kennedy Committee, which is the Kennedy-Dodd Committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension of the Senate. So a public option now, this is what where we are right this minute, is the Senate has to merge the Dodd Committee bill with the Baucus bill. And hopefully they put the public option in. And if leadership decides they want to do that, they can. And then it would take, according to Schumer, Charles Schumer, it would take 60 votes to take it out. And they don't have the 60 votes to take it out. So, you know, we could be getting it just from that maneuver alone. Or the next stage would be to when it merges with the House bill that it would be in it. So we have two chances, and I'm hoping that we get the first one.
Leonard Spinell, there's been some criticism from the left about the possibility of establishing a public option that's extremely weak and doesn't really help a lot of people. How important is it, even for a weak public option to be voted in into law here and President Obama to sign it? Do you have concerns about the bill?
And I do think you got to take the whole bill at it. It has some, you know, really milestones. But before I go into that, this public option does establish the precedent of setting up an insurance exchange where there would be private plans, but there also would be public plans. And either the employer, usually a small business employer or nonprofit, or an individual can choose which of the plans they want. And at least if you have a public option in there, the hope would be it would contain costs of the private insurance plans, which are essentially just driving, it's unsustainable. And Senator Klobuchar has put it very succinctly by saying 10 years ago, a private insurance plan for four people, a family of four, was $6,000. Today, that same policy is in the neighborhood of $12,000 to $13,000, and 10 years from now, it'll be $24,000. I mean, you just can't keep escalating like this. They're escalating, you know, every year, 7%, 10%, whatever. But so the hope is the public option will make this them have to be competitive to contain costs.
Eleanor Smeal, when it comes to women and health insurance in our current private market, what are the special hardships that women face in being able to afford good health care coverage?
A lot. Number one is we're charged more for the same coverage. According to government figures right now, around 48% more for similar product. So we're charged more. I've seen actually figures higher than that, but significantly more for the same product. The excuse that has been used for eons is, well, it's because of maternity coverage, but studies have been done to show that 79% of these private plans do not include maternity coverage. So that's a lark, too. I mean, essentially, we're charged more, and then maternity is frequently not covered, which is just ludicrous. And so one of the things that this the new whole insurance package that they're trying to get through is that it would prohibit sex discrimination in pricing. That's a big deal. We've been trying to get rid of that for several decades. So that's really important. Secondly, it would mandate that they have to include maternity. It cannot be excluded, maternity coverage. And then thirdly, other pre-existing conditions peculiarly affect women. Remember, it eliminates all pre-existing conditions. You can no longer use that as an excuse to deny coverage. And women who are domestic violence victims are denied coverage in 9 states right now. But also, it goes state by state, because remember, insurance is essentially state-regulated. This is going to essentially establish standards in health insurance. And so, for example, right now in some states they can exclude a second cesarean section delivery, saying that now that's a pre-existing condition because you've had one. Well, anyway, all these things would be eliminated. There's a lot of good things in this, you know. And I think the public, I do believe we must have a public option, but I also think we should know all the things that this is covering, and it is an advantage for people really of all ages.
Eleanor Shmi, a lot of people, of course, around the country are concerned about the cost of this health care plan or the various plans being debated, and certainly the right has attacked health care reform in general, saying, well, this is going to raise people's taxes. Young people are now going to be mandated to purchase insurance, even though they're healthy, and of course that helps reduce costs overall if the pool isn't sick and old.
Right.
But I wonder, do you see in the long run some real victories here in terms of cutting back the overall health care bill for the country if we get some of the minimum standards here met in a health care law?
Well, that's the hope. The hope is that you're doing several things by mandating that you have to have insurance coverage. You are going to lower the price, hopefully, because you're putting a lot more customers in, and that's one of the reasons also you need the public option to ensure that happens. But more important, or just as important as that, is that with these regulations, you're not dropping people if they get sick. I mean, what is the point of insurance if you get sick, they drop you? They call, you know, the second wave of cancer a pre-existing condition because you've had it once already. We know that, unfortunately, it frequently returns. I mean, essentially, it will also give coverage to millions of people who don't have it. And if we think we're not paying for that, we're fooling ourselves. One, we're paying for it in human suffering, and I do think we should have a humane policy that we want. One of the goals of government should be to eliminate human suffering. But secondly, is that you're paying for it because the person comes to the presents themselves to the emergency room far sicker because they couldn't afford to go to a doctor, so they only go when they have no choice. And so things that could be avoided are no longer, you're no longer able to avoid them. And so that also rises the price to all of us. We're paying for it now. And yet we have a very inhumane policies. When Lyndon Baines Johnson put in Medicare and Medicaid, and that was done in the 60s, they said, oh, we can't afford it. Well, we have been able to afford it, and the reality is for older people and very, very and limited parts of the poor, there's coverage, and it helped millions of people. And if the rest of the industrialized countries, all of Europe, can afford it, we can afford it. We just got to be able to afford it because it should be a basic human right.
Eleanor Shmuel, as someone who's worked tirelessly on behalf of women's rights, human rights, and social justice all these years, you must be frustrated that one of the things that is really blocking some of the health care reforms that have worked so well in Europe and around the other nations of the industrialized world is that we are combating and seemingly confronting legislators in Congress who want to maintain at all costs our for-profit healthcare system, when it seems eliminating the profit motive in healthcare would do us a world of good and bring us up to the standards of the rest of the world.
It baffles me that they can't, how these representatives from very small states can be holding the whole thing up. That's one of the frustrating things about the system is that a senator from a very small state has an equal vote to a senator from California. I really do believe that people need this desperately. It's really tragic. You know what I didn't even know, and I feel so stupid about this because I thought I did know about Medicaid, but Medicaid right now only covers kids under 6 years of age, the elderly, and a woman if she's pregnant, the disabled and the blind. But that means that if you're 8 years old and you come from a poor family and you got something that is curable but the family can't afford it, what does that do? What are we talking about here? Why? How can this be? Also, if you're pregnant, we'll cover you. But if you once you have the baby, the heck with you. I mean, even though you're totally impoverished. And, you know, these are cruel, stupid policies that are inhumane and don't really benefit the society as a whole. Because, you know, let's face it, if somebody's ill and it's not treated and it's contagious, it goes to other people. I mean, if you want to say it that way, I frankly feel that we should help people because they need help, not for fear that we'll get something from them. But the reality is it's also ignorant public policy. It's increasing the cost astronomically. And the other thing I can't understand is everybody says, oh, but people like it the way it is. Well, that's because, you know, do people really like paying these high prices for insurance? I mean, in other words, do they even know that it's one of the reasons our own businesses are not competitive with the rest of the world, because we have this screwy system where employers, if they do provide insurance, are not competitive to rest of it's a part of the package, where there is national health insurance. Anyway, for all these reasons, we desperately need the change, and I think we're on the threshold of it. I really do. I think that for example, it's now passed out of committee. How many committees now? A lot of these proposals. The only thing that seems to be at variance is the public option, which is very important, but there's more committees that have passed the public option than have not. We already have one house on it. And then I don't think the public even knows all the provisions that are so helpful to people. For example, now it will cover 100% of people who are at the federal poverty level, so that those illustrations I just gave will no longer be so. So it'll expand Medicaid to about 11 million people. I think it's a good thing. It will lighten up the emergency rooms, reduce costs because people won't be so sick when they present themselves to a hospital. And then there's so many other major benefits to this package, like eliminating sex discrimination, covering maternity, not knocking people out because of so-called pre-existing conditions, and not being able to knock somebody off coverage because you've reached a limit for payout for that year or your lifetime.
Eleanor Schmiel, you think President Obama will step up and push as hard as he can and really have a backbone here when it comes to, gaining ground here in the last few days of this debate? There are people who are troubled by some of his ambiguous stands here on the public option and other elements of this health care reform bill.
He said repeatedly he's for the public option. That isn't ambiguous. But I saw in some column this weekend, which I think is really true, he has gotten it as of now further than any president that has really tried to do it. And people have been doing it, since Teddy Roosevelt, but certainly since Truman. We've gotten it out of more committees. It is moving. There is a chance, I think a very good chance, he's going to sign a bill. So his strategy sometimes is baffling, but on the other hand, they're letting the Senate take the lead. But the president has made very clear which provisions he wants. So the question now is, are we going to let what the public wants? Because the public overwhelmingly in polls want the public option and want health insurance reform. Maybe they would want it even stronger than this. You know that those of us who are liberal would like a single-payer plan, but maybe this is a step. But whatever it is, we know one thing for sure. It will cover millions more people, and those people shouldn't suffer, and I'm hoping it passes.
We're speaking with Eleanor Schmiel, president of the Feminist Majority and a two-time president of the National Organization for Women, here on Counterpoint with myself, Scott Harris, on WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk. And, Eleanor, I did want to ask you your view here on what was behind what many are referring to as the AstroTurf groups that took to disrupting the town hall meetings with Congress people during the summer recess. They seem to have a lot of success in distracting the media and creating the image of a country outraged at the prospect of health care reform, which certainly isn't reflected in the polling. But it did create a real dent in support for some of the directions that health care reform was headed. Do you think these...
organized.
Yeah, I wanted to find out where you think this comes from, because...
It was organized and paid for various insurance interests. They have a lot at stake. I mean, let's face it, they've been coddled. There's no, essentially no federal regulations. They've been exempted from the antitrust laws. And even though they can see, I mean, it doesn't take a great mathematician to say this is not sustainable, but they don't seem to care. They're going to take it every dime they can for as long as they can. But it's, you know, I can remember 30 years ago people saying this is terrible, not sustainable, heartless, and every other word. But they've been able to hold on, and I guess what they want to do is just hold on during their watch. I do think they peaked too soon. I think that they're doing it over the summer gave our side a chance to recuperate. And, you know, one thing I've learned about in politics, it's only the last weeks that count anyway.
Yep, truly said, truly said. It seems that this really is the moment for grassroots activism to hold the president and members of Congress accountable for what they do on this, you know, once-in-a-generation opportunity to have some real substantive and change for the better with health care reform.
Right.
What do you suggest our listeners do to make a difference at this moment?
Oh, they should tell Senator Reid, please put public option in that merge bill. In the leadership of the Senate, they should get to every senator. Of course, in Connecticut, the Dodd Committee, your Senator Dodd, has already voted for the public option. But I think the more they hear anyway, they, you know, it juices people up. They fight more. But everybody can call can get to the majority leader and the whip, Durbin. They both are for the public option, by the way. But again, they should hear from you. And I think the opposition should hear from him, too, that you're sick and tired of it, that you want this. But I just don't think people should sit quietly. This is it. We're in the final days here. And I think we got a chance to make history. I believe, actually, it's going to pass. I don't know if I'm if I'm just being too optimistic. But I think the public wants it, and I think a majority of both houses want it. Now the question is, can they hold us up on some parliamentary procedure, some filibuster? But you know, it's a time to make history, and it wasn't easy when Medicaid and Medicare passed. I was just a kid then, but I can remember how happy my mother was when Medicare passed, and I think it has helped millions of seniors. This is going to help millions and millions of people, and then also it's going to help our country straighten out its books, because what's happening right now is just too. This is what we have right now is not sustainable and far too expensive for too little.
And, Eleanor Smeal, before you go, say a word about some of the projects you're working on at your group, Feminist Majority.
Well, obviously, we're very concerned with this health care, but we're also have this is a great time for women's rights. We're working on major things. For example, this week has been released in a report showing that women are going to be the majority of the United States workforce. Well, we want, but the contract, the social contract, the governmental policies are still reflecting a world of 1935 when very few, you know, smaller percentage of women were employed and there were housewives, housewives were the majority. But so we're being cheated in pay, or there's still sex discrimination. There's no paid family medical leave, either for men or women, taking care of children or taking care of elderly parents. And there's not – this is a stunning thing, I think. This is a stunning statistic that today in the United States, about half of women workers – do not have one, when I say women workers, women paid workers, employees, do not have one paid sick day. Can you imagine that? Not one. And there's a bill that we want passed that would provide a guarantee of sick leave. The bill has 7 days. We would like to have at least two weeks. But and then we want paid family medical leave. Obama has been for these bills, so we're hoping with a positive president in there rather than one that would block everything, that we will turn around these social policies that are totally out of date and out of step, really, with the rest of the major industrialized countries, certainly out of step with Europe.
Well, Eleanor Schmiel, it's been great to have you here. Thanks for spending time with us and giving us your analysis of this important moment in healthcare reform history. And I'll just mention going out here that Connecticut's other senator, Joseph Lieberman, who's lately been calling himself an independent, you know, could be a key senator in a cloture
vote. I should have said that. I wanted to make sure that everybody knew that Senator Dodd was in the right place.
Right.
But I think they got to make sure that Mr. Lieberman is, too.
Yeah,
and because he could be a key vote. Let's face it, every vote's going to count, and every push is going to count. I think if Senator Kennedy was here, it would be easier, but he isn't.
Right.
But I am very hopeful. I think that we can do it. We're the closest we've been. I mean, this is the closest we've been in years and years and years. And so I think we should run with the ball and take it and make some history here. And then, you know, there's a lot on the plate of the administration, mainly because, you know, we went backwards for so many years. But I sure do like the forward movement. By the way, we've already gotten some major wins for women. We passed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Not enough, but at least it corrected a terrible Supreme Court decision under the, not too long ago, but it was done with conservative judges. We turn that around. We have some more other Fair Pay Acts that we hope can pass that will even give us more strength. We've increased family planning funding. There's been a lot of gains, and I can't go through them all because I know we're at the end. But it feels good that there's forward movement. We can't just keep looking backwards. We've got to welcome the 21st century and fine-tune ourselves so that we're competitive and yet be very humane to everybody.
One last thing before you go. What's the website of your group, Feminist Majority?
It's feminist.org, www.feminist.org. And we have all the features of the health care reform bills and how they benefit women, many more than what I just said. But we have a lot of other things because we're not only active domestically, we're active worldwide, and we're trying to help Afghan women. We've been on that campaign since 1996, one of the first groups in this country. In fact, we were the first group to point out that the dangers of the Taliban and the horrific treatment of women, and that struggle is not over. But we cover a huge number of issues. And, some things I said politically that we're going forward on, but we also do clinic violence defense work. And as you know, we've had the tragedy of the killing of the Dr. Tiller, an abortion provider in Kansas, and violence at the clinics there has been escalating. You can't have freedom of choice or reproductive rights for women if you can have terror right here in our own country. So we're hoping that that will calm down. The same thing happened after the election of Clinton, and now we're having it after the election of Obama. But we're determined that with good law enforcement and with an aware constituency and community, pro-choice activists, that there will be less violence and it'll calm down.
Yeah, we're going to be speaking with a former religious right activist, Frank Schaefer, a little later tonight, who's come over to the other side. And he's one of the specific points that horrified him was the assassination of Dr. George Tiller. So
it's just horrible. Yeah. I mean, because you can't have a democracy if one side loses and then they take to the streets and start bombing and assassinating people. This is just, terrible. You can see the what religious extremism has led to in other countries, and we can't have it here.
Well said. And in closing, Eleanor Smith, thanks so much for being here, and thanks, and I speak for all of our listeners, I'm sure, or most of them. We appreciate all the hard work you've done all these years.
Well, thank you so much, and let's keep pushing. I hope the audience, everybody, gets make sure that their senators, Senator Lieberman certainly knows that you want a public option and that you want this health care insurance reform to pass, and thank Senator Dodd for his work, and make sure he is hears from you, because I think the people fight more even when they know the public's behind them.
All right, and that's certainly true. Good night, Eleanor. Thanks
night.
For being here.
Okay,
good night.
Hey, hey, everyone, underneath the shining sun, have you heard the news that's going round? For the days of betrayal and disbelief are done, announcing that the tide is turned around. From the stillness in between, when the wave was to be seen, and everybody's hopes were sinking down. Well, the wind kicked in, and a breaker just rolled in, announcing that the tide is turned around. And the jetty is once in place to divide us in our race, broken as the waves has been rejoined. Up to their sleeves as the cheers of everybody bring them round. For the net of the world is falling in good hands, announcing that the tide is turned around.
Music from Stephen Smith here on WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. We'll be back with a talk about the cap and trade climate change bill and its status in Washington with Harvey Wasserman in just a moment, so stay with us.
To understand the American economy in the last 30 years amounts to this. Employers no longer raise the wages of their workers. Instead, they lent them the money, which he has to pay back with interest.
Renowned University of Massachusetts economics professor Richard Wolff is coming to the Unitarian Church in Hamden on Saturday, October 24th, where using his film and recently published book, he'll present a revealing examination of the Wall Street schemes that triggered the economic collapse. Wolff's analysis differs sharply from most other explanations offered by economists and politicians and expands on the message delivered in Michael Moore's new film, Capitalism, A Love Story. This public forum addressing the nation's worst economic downturn since the Great Depression is titled Capitalism Hits the Fan, the Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It, and will be held from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Saturday, October 24th at the Unitarian Church, 700 Hartford Turnpike, Hamden, Connecticut. Richard Wolff's talk and Q&A with the audience will be preceded by a screening of the film Capitalism Hits the Fan, based on Professor Wolff's recent lectures, and followed by a book signing and reception. Net proceeds from the event will benefit Squeaky Wheel Productions, nonprofit distributor of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, broadcast nationwide. Seating is limited, and advance reservations are recommended. For more information, directions, or to make reservations, call area code 203-268-8446 or visit us on the web at squeakywheel.net. That's Professor Richard Wolff discussing the global economic meltdown and what to do about it from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Saturday, October 24th at the Unitarian Church in Hamden. For more information and reservations, call 203-268-8446 or visit squeakywheel.net.
They say we're back. Happens up. It fails us now. Come in. Let us be the time.
Hope you'll join us there. And Gang of Four will not be appearing at this. The music that you heard there in the background, that band, one of my favorites, but they won't be there at the Saturday event, but Professor Richard Wolff will be. Right now, I'd like to welcome to the program Harvey Wasserman, writer and activist, senior advisor to the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and senior editor at freepress.org. Harvey is the author of his latest book, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. And Harvey has a new piece titled, at the freepress.org website, titled, Is the Climate Bill Being Fossil Nuked? Harvey, thanks for being here tonight.
Hey, great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, so some disturbing news out of the Senate, especially when it comes to this cap and trade bill, and a recent announcement made by Lindsey Graham, Senator of South Carolina, and John Kerry of Massachusetts, that really talks about including some incentives to build more nuclear power plants and build more offshore oil drilling platforms. This sounds like a real nasty bit of business here that's going on in the Senate. Tell us what's happening here.
Well, the John Kerry is paving the way for a so-called compromise on, fighting climate chaos by opening the door to everything that causes it. I mean, he is on the quote that staggered me the most is a quote from something that he and Lindsey Graham jointly said, which is that they want to make the United States the Saudi Arabia of clean coal. I mean, I assume this means that they're going to blow off every mountain in West Virginia. And the place will turn into sand with camels walking across it. That's not the only Saudi Arabia I can link with clean coal. And they're also, of course, talking about new nuclear plants, which is pathologically insane, have no impact, no positive impact whatsoever on global warming. The only way to fight global warming is to take the defense budget and use it to totally make this country efficient and give it a mass transit system. But anything in the interim is going to be nonsense. And so what Kerry, who's very, of course, powerful now in the Senate, he's been there a long time, he's chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, is doing is running interference in the name of bipartisanship, is running interference for what I call King Kong, or coal, oil, nukes, and gas.
I don't know if you heard about this, but the notorious political spoof group, the Yes Men, came out with a phony press release this morning from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that endorsed the climate change bill, cap and trade, which, you know, is ironic because they've been opposing it for so long. But given these changes here and this compromise by Kerry and Lindsey Graham, it wasn't so ironic at all.
Well, it's not really a compromise. It's a complete sellout. I mean, you know, first of all, cap and trade itself is very problematic. The whole scheme reeks of, shall we say, corporate corruption. It's a multi-billion-dollar bureaucracy that they're going to set up, and they're going to sell credits. In fact, give away credits, and you know, it's just ridiculous, and it's not going to help fight. It's not going to help fight global warming in the least. Cap and trade. What we need to do is have a serious tax on carbon that also taxes ancillary environmental costs, such as radioactive waste, heating of rivers, potential for meltdowns, all that basic stuff that comes with nuclear power.
Harvey, could you take a step back and tell our listeners a bit about how cap and trade works and why you think it won't be effective here at reducing carbon emissions?
It's just another bureaucracy. And, you know, it's gonna set up a stock exchange in carbon. Nobody's really gonna know what to do with it. And it'll be completely corrupted. It's way too complicated and doesn't get at the core of the issue. We need to have a carbon tax that's supplemented with a tax on other forms of pollution that go along with the various energy forms. And if you, we can also have a feed-in tariff, which works very well in Europe, where you pay a higher fee for renewable energy sources, but you know the fee is geared to the pollution that's avoided by the renewable generating facilities. So solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, sustainable biofuels, these all get feed-in tariff support, which they deserve, and which because they avoid pollution. But, you know, Kerry is talking about not only solving the nuclear waste problem, which hasn't been done for 50 years, and in fact the nuclear industry is in worse shape now than it was 50 years ago. At least 50 years ago they had the so-called promise of Yucca Mountain. Yucca Mountain's gone. And, you know, it's just not, there's nothing on the horizon for the solution to nuclear waste in this country. It's an astonishing development. The first atomic reactor opened at Shippingport, Pennsylvania in 1957, and 52 years later, there's nothing to do with the high-level nuclear waste except leave it where it is. This is the basis that they're going to build new nuclear plants, and John Kerry suddenly is going to come forth with a solution for radioactive waste after 52 years of failure? I don't think so. The same now, they're also talking about carbon sequestration, which is this idea of taking the carbon dioxide emissions from coal plants and pumping them into the ground. I mean, it's lunacy. It's untried. It's extremely expensive by any stretch of the imagination. There's no guarantee it'll work. Why are they even talking about this when we have the solution ready at hand? We need to take a gigantic step forward for increased efficiency, which we know works, which is cheaper, safer, cleaner, and faster to install than anything else, and also rebuild our mass transit system. If you do those two things alone, we'll be miles down the road to solving the global warming problem.
Harvey Wasserman, in this bill is something called the Clean Energy Development Administration. What is that designed to do, and how many billions of dollars is that particular administration or government apparatus going to throw at the nuclear power industry in subsidies?
Well, we're not clear yet. The final design of that agency has not been laid out. It could serve as a vehicle to funnel immense amounts of money to build new nuclear plants. And, you know, but that's still up in the air. It's allegedly, you know, its green face, its green paint is to make it look like it's going to fund renewables. But, in fact, it could be used to fund, increased nuclear power plants. And it's just a potential disaster. But it's still very much up for grabs. And we don't, there need to be limits. If they're going to do this thing, there need to be limits on how much money can go to an individual technology and whether any can go to nuclear or not. And the bottom line is, and people have to understand, the nuclear industry wants, you know, to completely gut the regulation process, as if there, you know, the regulation process already is a complete joke. The public is virtually entirely excluded from the nuclear regulatory process. Although I must say that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just came down with an astonishing ruling on the application for a new Westinghouse reactor, the AP1000, which is pretty much the core of the so-called nuclear renaissance. And they said basically it's not doable, that there are flaws in this design that would make it vulnerable to natural disasters, which is coming from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's astonishing. At any rate, what's really going to matter in the climate and energy legislation coming out of the Congress in the next 6 months is whether or not the nuclear industry gets direct loan guarantees or subsidies. And without them, this is another failure of the nuclear power industry. Without those loan guarantees or subsidies, they can't move forward because nuclear power is a complete failure in the financial markets. Nobody will grant, nobody will invest in nuclear power without massive government subsidies or guarantees. And so without those, it's a non-starter. You can you know, talk about funding a solution for the nuclear waste. You can get rid of what, you know, shreds remain of the licensing process. But if you don't give the nuclear industry tons and tons and tons of money, then no new reactors are going to be built. And that's where we really need to fight them.
Harvey, since the Three Mile Island near nuclear meltdown in Pennsylvania.
Well, it was a meltdown, actually. It was a near explosion, is what it was.
Right.
It did melt.
Since Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania in 1979 and Chernobyl in the Ukraine in 1986, has public opinion sweetened at all on nuclear power here and that's being proposed in this bill
Well, depends on how you word the survey. If you say, do you support nuclear power to fight global warming? then, you know, you've made the assumption already that nuclear power fights global warming and people will support it. But it doesn't fight global warming. If you say, do you support nuclear power and will you pay, have the government pay for the reactors, that's a whole other that's a whole other sampling, a whole other response. And, you know, so if the surveys are done honestly, then the support for nuclear is not there. If they word them in a way that, you know, prejudges the situation, then, you know, they can claim support. But the bottom line is, you know, they've there are two states where the utility industry is, or the nuclear industry has gone in and gotten the Public Utilities Commission to force the public to pay for nuclear power plants as they're being built. And we've seen this before. This happened at Seabrook in New Hampshire and other places. It's called construction work in progress. It's a total scam because the utilities building the reactors then don't really care if the reactors ever actually get finished. In fact, they just soon have them go on forever because they can continue to raise rates to pay for them. And in this case, in Florida and in Georgia, rates have gone up by as much as 30% to pay for new nuclear plants that have not even had their designs approved and can't come online in less than a decade, and in the last 3 or 4 years have jumped from $2 billion to $13 billion. So, you know, this is not a hopeful sign for new nuclear plants. There's a nuclear plant being built by Areva, the French company in Finland, which is already years over ahead of behind schedule. I'm sorry, it's years behind schedule and billions of euros over budget, and the same thing is actually happening in France. Areva likes to blame their problems on Finland and on the regulators in Finland. They have no such problems in France, but they're still having the same catastrophic over-budget and behind-schedule problems. So this technology is unworkable. Nuclear technology has failed. It's inappropriate, has no place in the 21st century, and is going to do nothing but harm our attempts to solve the global warming problem.
Now, when uranium is mined and turned into fuel rods, that is part of the nuclear power chain there. And that process, as I understand it, creates a lot of carbon. So this idea that nuclear power somehow reduces our carbon emissions when we generate power is somewhat founded on a myth. Tell us some more about
totally.
That.
And it also creates a tremendous amount of radon gas. There are gargantuan, and I use that term advisedly, piles of tailings, which is basically waste sand from uranium mines and mills in the west, in Durango, Colorado, and other places. And these, we're talking about billions of tons of tailings that emit very large quantities of radon gas, which is radioactive, and has been detected as far as away as the East Coast, thousands of miles, including in New York City. From the, you know, it's identifiable as having come from these uranium piles in tailings in Colorado. So this is a there are other hidden carbon costs. Of course, you have to refine the uranium and turn it into fuel rods, enrich it, and the enrichment process is enormously energy intensive. In fact, the Portsmouth enrichment facility in Ohio, when it was operating, used as much electricity as the city of Cleveland. They tend to not figure, and they got the power from coal plants. So, you know, they tend to not figure that in when they talk about the alleged power of nuclear energy to solve the global warming problem. In fact, the opposite is true. We're also seeing, you know, global warming, I mean, nuclear power kind of eliminates the middleman in global warming. With global warming, we're primarily concerned right now about greenhouse gases that trap heat from the sun, but in fact, nuclear power plants emit, turn inert uranium into massive quantities of heat directly. We've had incidents now in France and in Alabama where nuclear plants had to shut because they were heating the rivers used to cool the reactors up to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's a great way to fight global warming, is to warm your rivers to 90 degrees. And in fact, they had to shut down some of the reactors, both in the U.S. and in France this past summer, because it was too hot and the water bodies that they were sitting on were too hot to cool the reactors. So, you know, how does that fit into the fight on global warming?
All in very important questions that is not really answered from what, you know, little I've seen of this proposed bill here in the Senate. But Harvey Wasserman, I wanted to ask you about the Republicans and their position here. There are a few Republicans that have come forward to support some kind of cap and trade bill, including Lindsey Graham. But do you think there's a larger game being played here to get as many concessions as possible for the energy industry?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, the energy industry is just, you know, King Kong, as we call it, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, just owns these guys. And, you know, John Kerry, who's portrayed as this great liberal, never saw a cause that he wouldn't sell out. I mean, now he's, you know, waffling on Afghanistan. I'm talking about supporting an escalation in Afghanistan after he himself went into, you know, Vietnam and saw the catastrophe in Vietnam. Now he seems to want to repeat it in Afghanistan. And let me tell you, if this country escalates that war in Afghanistan, we have no future. I mean, you know, we are. When we went into Vietnam, we had a financial cushion that is long gone. And any escalation in Afghanistan is just going to destroy any possible chance that this economy could ever seriously recover. And the same is true of building new nuclear plants. Every dime spent on nuclear power has been wasted. If the money that had gone into nuclear power instead had gone into increased efficiency and renewables and mass transit, when they started with this nonsense back in the 50s, we would have a very, very different country. And it will be a much, much healthier, much more prosperous, and much safer country. I mean, we don't even begin to talk about the national security dangers of nuclear power and the fact that the guys who flew the planes into the World Trade Center had seriously considered flying at least one of the planes into Indian Point, the nuclear reactors on the Hudson River north of New York City, which would, of course, have devastated Connecticut. I mean, the Connecticut... Had they done that, Connecticut would have long ago been evacuated, and you know, the American economy would be a vast wasteland.
Well, Harvey, I wanted to ask you this finally. There is a very important United Nations conference on climate change that's going to be taking place in Copenhagen, Denmark, in December. Tell our listeners a bit about the interplay between the push to get this cap-and-trade bill passed in Congress and what President Obama is expected to bring to the table in Copenhagen.
Not clear. I mean, you know, the Democrats are desperate to get a bill, which is why this is so dangerous. And, you know, the Republican strategy on the health care bill was, you know, whine and moan and drag your feet and demand concession after concession and get all these concessions from the Democrats and then not vote for the bill anyway. And that's what's going to happen on the climate bill. You know, John McCain and all these other pro-nuclear guys have demanded, including Lieberman, by the way, Senator Lieberman, have demanded that all this nuclear stuff go into the climate bill, which is ridiculous. But McCain has said he'll never vote for a bill that includes cap and trade. And so what he's going to do is just going to, you know, chip away and make sure that there's nothing significant for renewables because they compete with coal, oil, nukes, and gas. And there'll be stuff for coal, alleged clean coal, which does not exist, and for nuclear power. And then he'll back away from the bill anyway. The Republicans want Obama to go to Copenhagen empty-handed. But the bottom line for me is, look, if these guys want to do a pro-nuclear, pro-fossil fuel climate bill, then kill the bill and let the EPA take over regulating emissions. I'd rather have the EPA, straight out, Environmental Protection Agency, flat out regulating carbon emissions than have a bill that comes in and supports nuclear power and so-called clean coal. I mean, there are three great oxymorons in America right now: safe nuclear, clean coal, and Rush Limbaugh. Those are the oxymorons, and you know, we got to defeat all three.
Well said, Harvey. And before we go, do you have any hopes for some real groundbreaking movement towards global curtailment of carbon emissions and global warming at this conference in Copenhagen?
Well, it's happening every day. I'm not thinking about Copenhagen. I'm thinking about the growth of the renewable energy industry and how people at the grassroots are switching to solar and wind. And, you know, the next big thing we have to have in this country, we have to have two big things. We have to have a gigantic push for increased efficiency. I mean, you know, everybody's whining and moaning about how we have to have more energy production and this and that. I walk around, I teach at two colleges, I must turn off 50 lights a day. I mean, people, there's like no acknowledgement by our institutions, the universities included, that we have a problem, that we need to conserve our energy and not waste so much. We still waste 50% of the energy that we consume in this country. So that's got to stop. And along with that, we have to rebuild our mass transit system. You know, Europe, which uses far less energy per capita than we do, is, you know, evolving to a much higher standard of living because they have mass transportation. And you can actually go places in Europe without a car, and you can get there faster than you would with a car. So we have to have rail, passenger rail restored between our cities and inside our cities. And once we do those two things, increase our efficiency and restore mass transit, we will be a long way up the road to solving global warming. And I think, you know, as people, as the energy, renewable energy industry booms, which it is doing, a lot of that is going to really fall into place.
Well, Harvey, thanks for your all your research, your articles, and your optimistic state of mind.
Well, I've never seen a good use for pessimism. You can come see me at solartopia.org is my website.
Okay.
Solartopia.org and harveywasserman.com is where I have my books. And thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and the just one last website we want to make sure to repeat, freepress.org. where you and Mr. Fetrakis have a good number of articles there, including this one about the climate bill that you just wrote. Is the climate bill being fossil nuked? That can be found at freepress.org, right?
Yes, and it's also at solartopia.org.
Good. Okay. Harvey, again, thanks for being there.
Hey, thank you, man. Anytime. It's a great station.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye. Harvey Wasserman, writer and activist, and again, his most recent book is Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth AD 2030. And we'll take a musical break here and be back with a former right-wing religious activist who's turned his back on his former allies and has come to the other side. We'll hear why from Frank Schaefer in just a moment or two here on WPKM in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk, and the program is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and we'll be right back.
Lost everything. Eventually, things might be okay. As he's standing there, with all that's left of life, before the ocean rose and took it all away. I was at the mosque, I wasn't on the shore. I guess it was my lucky day. And when I got back home, there was no one there. The ocean rose and took them all away. We were fighting for independence. That's all I was thinking yesterday. Now all I'm thinking is we're on an island. And the ocean rose and took them all away. Trees all were cut, and this is how we all had to pay. Maybe Mr. Ford was on vacation in Thailand when the ocean rose and took it all away. This had happened in Kyoto or San Francisco. I wonder what they'd say, but this ain't new. It's just Aceh, where the ocean rolls and took it all away.
Loans.
got off the plane, looked at no one. Walked down the tarmac in the direction of nowhere. Followed the sun as it was setting. Glad to be done with all the bloodletting. There were no banners for the proud and the few. Just workers in airports that do what they do. Fuel up the planes, unload the bags, along with the cops, all covered in flags. When Johnny came marching, the town he was from was a dead little place. So he looked for a job somewhere off base. In the city of pawn shops, hotels and bars, gas stations, strip clubs, highways and cars. He went to a dive, ordered a beer, said turn the music up loud, so it's all that I hear. Try to rewind, turn back the years, stop the explosions between my ears. When Johnny came marching in, jobs were all cheap, beer was cheap. Besides, there was no other way to sleep. Still, the screams and the guns would wake him at night. He was always on edge and ready to fight. When he closed his eyes, he would just see the face of a woman he killed in some faraway place. Over and over, the white of her eyes and her final and terrible, terrified cry. Johnny came marching. Just told him it's all in his head, but he couldn't stop drinking or get out of bed. And with no place to go but the wrong way, it was a shock to his ears when he heard himself say over and over to anyone within range, "Hey mister, can you spare some change?" When Johnny came marching, great nation. Millions of riot cops were milling everywhere. They were eating meatball subs. They were swinging billy clubs. Then there came a thunderous noise right above us in the air. RPG, RPG. I can hear the people all shouting out with glee. And when I look up to the sky, I can't help but wonder why that helicopter's circling right above me. RPG. I was singing like a bird, just trying to be heard, singing on the stage some wistful melody. And there seemed to be consensus with that copter up above us. There was just one song, now that might have a harmony. RPG, RPG. I can hear the people all shouting out with glee. And when I looked up to the sky,
that's the music from David Rovix. Actually, we heard several selections there from David Rovix's CD called Halliburton Boardroom Massacre. Got some great songs in there we haven't heard in the past. We had a little trouble reaching our scheduled guest, Frank Schaefer. But fortunately, I've got Brett Kimberlin, who's going to be ably filling in here to talk about some of these same and some different issues with us tonight. Brett Kimberlin is with a group called Velvet Revolution. And I welcome you to the program, Brett. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks a lot for having me on. I'm sorry if Frank couldn't make it. He's tied up with some other things right now, but I've been working with him for a long time, so I think I can fill in fairly well.
Yeah, well, you could tell us a little bit about your group first, Velvet Revolution, and the work you've been doing on electoral politics and securing the vote and a lot of other important issues you guys deal with. And then we could get a little bit into Frank, and hopefully we'll get Frank back here another time to speak up on his own behalf. But, yeah, tell us about Velvet Revolution.
Velvet Revolution, we've been around about 5 years. We started out dealing with the election debacle of 2004 and brought together a lot of activist groups to complain about the use of electronic voting machines and how they were easily riggable and not reliable and so on and so forth. And so we've now grown to 150 organizations representing well over a million members. And we've expanded our campaigns to other areas like media reform, government accountability, getting out of Iraq. And we've had really good success on the election front. We pushed for paper ballots. We had whistleblowers give us machines that we, voting machines that we then had analyzed by Princeton computer scientists who were able to show that, that these machines could be rigged in a couple minutes and that actually could manipulate an entire election once that, that happened. So we've been very successful there, and we have this we have several new campaigns that we've launched. One called BeboldReturnOurMoney.com, and that is asking Diebold to return $100 million to the state of California for charging that much money for machines that, that didn't work and that were not certified to be used in elections. And so we're demanding that, that Diebold return the money, and if they don't within 90 days, that the state of California sue them for that money and that the Secretary of State permanently decertify the Diebold machines. Just today we're reporting that the in a mock election down in Florida this last week, the Diebold machines again failed. So it's pretty widespread and well known. And then we have another campaign called, that we just launched this week called StopTheChamber.com, and that's, we're asking that the Chamber of Commerce be stopped in its tracks. The Chamber of Commerce has been manipulating elections for years with fake censors and so on and so forth, but they've also come out with a $100 million campaign to oppose health care for all and environmental protections and financial regulations. So it just launched a couple of days ago. It's had thousands of people have signed on. It's getting a lot of press coverage, and we're asking that the Department of Justice investigate the Chamber of Commerce. We're asking that Congress hold hearings on the Chamber's illegalities and unethical conduct, and that Chamber President Tom Donahue be fired. And we're asking companies to abandon the Chamber and quit paying dues into an organization that's basically become an arm of the Republican Party. And then the campaign that, that Frank Schaefer is involved with is called StopDomesticTerror.com. And we've been working on this campaign for since about June, right after the Dr. Tiller was killed, assassinated by a religious fundamentalist in the Midwest, because Dr. Tiller was helping the women with their reproductive health. And then we saw the shooting at the Holocaust Museum, and the police were shot in Pittsburgh, and then the Minutemen shot a family in Arizona. So we've seen a lot of right-wing violence. And then couple that with all the Tea Party fanaticism and the militias and the birthers and people saying that Obama is not a legitimate president. So we launched this campaign called StopDomesticTerror.com, and Frank Schaefer has been one of the spokespeople for it because he's been talking about the rise in religious fundamentalism and how they view bad news as good news, and that they look for the return of Christ and the end of time, and so they think that that Obama is a sign of the end of the times, and they justify the terror tactics and violent actions through the use of the Bible, and some of the militias are using the Constitution to justify this. They say that they have a moral obligation to commit violence to protect whatever they believe in, and so our campaign, StopDomesticTerror.com, is an important campaign because we've asked the Department of Justice to fully prosecute threats and acts of violence and to investigate the use of the media to incite violence. We also ask Congress to hold hearings on the responsibility of licensed media to conduct itself in the public interest. We are urging legislation to require diversity in the media and broader minority ownership of FCC licenses, because right now we have a basic monopoly of rising media in many areas of the country. So we need to deal with that, and we're asking advertisers to stop advertising on media that espouses hate and violence. And we're also asking, through Frank Schaefer, asking other religious leaders to come forward and take a stand against violence in the media and, you know, domestically. So it's a very broad campaign, and it's picked up a lot of coverage. It's been written about, you know, in the mainstream press, and many well-known commentators have been talking about the same thing. Tom Friedman warned about it, New York Times, Roger Ebert, you know, was talking about it, and Frank Schaefer wrote a wonderful article in the Huffington Post last week endorsing the campaign fully. So thousands of people have signed on to that, and we've got lots of organizations signed on to it. So if anybody's listening out there, it's StopDomesticTerror.com, and go to the website, and you can sign on right there and help make a difference.
Yeah, and the main website is VelvetRevolution.us, correct?
Right.
Okay.
We have, like I said, multiple campaigns going right now, five very active campaigns, two of them that I have not mentioned yet, but if you want me to.
Well, we'll have some time for that, but, you know, probably do. I think we're on a cell phone here, and it's coming in kind of muffled, so if there's anything you could do to speak more directly into the little speaker there. It may not work. We'll give it a try. We can hear you. It's just a little muffled, and we'll make the best of it. But I want to reintroduce you to our audience here. Brett Kimberlin is on the line. He's with the website VelvetRevolution.us and affiliated with our guest that was scheduled here tonight. Unfortunately, we had trouble reaching him, but that's Frank Schaefer, a former religious right activist and author. And hopefully we'll get him back here to tell his story about how he sort of moved to the other side on his views, especially, I think, as you mentioned, Brett, the assassination of Dr. George Tiller in Kansas, the abortion doctor, who was, assassinated in cold blood by a religious activist, really shook Frank Schaefer up, and it should have shaken up a lot of people, because the bombings of clinics and other assassinations of doctors is a continual pattern of behavior that speaks to the danger of religious fundamentalism gone amok. And, it's sort of ironically, and it's certainly, I guess, the other side of the coin, an anti-abortion activist was recently killed, and that was a rallying point for many of those anti-abortion groups that preach a lot of hatred and demonstrate in front of the abortion clinics and the like. You want to comment on that kind of turn of hand there, where there was a man arrested, of course, for that hateful act of shooting in cold blood this anti-abortion activist, but it was used by the religious right as a rallying point. You want to speak to that?
Well, yeah, I'd like to talk about that. I mean, we're obviously opposed to any type of violence from the right or the left, and I think that there are some slight nuance differences between those. I mean, that guy that shot the anti-abortion activist, you know, was out on a rampage, a killing spree, and I think he shot several other people and was caught and went to kill another person, and I think the other people that he was planning to kill or did kill had nothing to do with abortion. So I think the guy was nuts, rather than doing it because he had an agenda. And, you know, that's the difference I'd like to point out here, where in the case of Scott Roeder, who shot Dr. Tiller, he had been vandalizing abortion clinics for years and had been identified, and the FBI knew about him, and instead of prosecuting him for violating the Federal Access to Clinic Act, they just went out and talked to him, or, you know, asked him not to do it, or whatever. And this all happened, most of this happened under the Bush administration, which had a very lax policy of not prosecuting these types of events. And so obviously these people were emboldened, and that's one of the things that we've asked Eric Holder. You know, when anybody is caught vandalizing, whether it's, you know, gluing a door shut or cutting a chain or painting a graffiti on a clinic or something like that, these things should be prosecuted fully so that the people do not go to the next level and commit violence. But I've spent a lot of time with Frank Schaefer, and, you know, we've discussed this. And if you go to the website, shopdomesticterror.com, you can see some of the interviews of Frank Schaefer. And we have I interviewed him for 90 minutes, and we've broken it up into 7 YouTube videos, about 10 minutes each. So people can really see what he's talking about and how he thinks that the religious leaders out there actually want these acts of violence to occur, and they'll come out and publicly denounce them after they happen. But once they close the doors, they pop champagne and say, well, when can we get another fringe nutcase to, you know, assassinate the next person? And so he's calling out the religious leaders and saying, you know, you have to step up and take responsibility here and call these people out and cooperate with the government so these things don't happen.
All right. Brett Kimberlin, I know you mentioned the media as certainly being one source of the venom and hate that's spewed by some of these right-wing talk show hosts like Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, Michael Savage, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and a host of others around the country. Do you think there's a direct link between some of the violence we've seen here since President Obama has been elected and the kinds of rantings that come out of these right-wing talk show hosts?
Well, I know there's a direct connection. I mean, we've seen in some of these assassinations, when the people have been arrested, they've had some of these right-wing commentators' books in their possession. Even Scott Roeder, you know, he was carrying a note with the Operation Rescue phone number on it. And we've seen with the town hall birther movement, teabaggers, you know, a lot of the hate and racism against Obama and the government, and these same people are following Glenn Beck or O'Reilly, and they're saying that's where they get their information. And so when they hear that Obama's not an American citizen, or he's a Muslim, or he's a communist or a socialist or something, they don't get that from themselves. They get that from these right-wing commentators who are trying to foment and incite violence. And, you know, the thing that Frank and I are both worried about is that some lunatic is going to go out there and take a shot at Obama and think that they're doing it because one of these commentators or religious leaders or whatever has given them the green light and egged them on and said, you have the moral right to do this. So they compare Obama to Hitler or, you know, the Germany in the 30s and 40s, and you know, they tell these people that somebody should have taken out Hitler the same way that somebody should take out Obama. And I mean, if you go to the website, we have links to other internet sites where they're talking about this crazy stuff there's one thing where we sent to the Attorney General, which showed that there was an organization that believes that 30 to 50 million liberals should be killed over the next 6 years because they supported Obama and they believe that this is going to happen. These things need to be addressed, and that's what this campaign is all about.
Okay, and that website is stopdomesticterror.com, is that right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, stopdomesticterror.com. And the guest we hope to have back another time, Frank Schaefer, we couldn't contact him tonight, and I'm sure we'll be able to reschedule at some point. But Brett Kimberlin, it's been great to have you fill in here tonight.
Anytime, you know, just holler at me. I'm sorry he couldn't get on tonight. I know he's been really busy. He's got a brand new book that just came out this week, and so he's in a very big demand. So this probably just slipped through the cracks, and I'm sure he'd love to come back on it.
Yeah, we certainly will. And our listeners should also, in addition to the StopDomesticTerror.com website, they can check out the organization that's behind this and other campaigns, and that's VelvetRevolution.us, where there's a whole host of good reading there on things that you're working on.
Right.
So, Brett, again, appreciate the last-minute nature of you filling in here and getting some good information out to the listeners tonight. So thanks again.
All right. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Take care, Brett. Good night. And Brett Kimberlin of VelvetRevolution.us. And that does it for our program tonight. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next Monday evening at 8 o'clock with another Counterpoint program. We hope you'll stick around. And we also hope that you will support this station in this week coming up during our fund drive, the five or so days less of the fund drive. The station has been a home for free thought and free expression for almost 40 years now or over 40 years, and we're hoping we continue on here, but that's only possible with your contributions and your monetary support. There's been a recent schedule change, and whether you like it or you don't like it, the fact is this station needs to be here. The programming can change again, and with your input and volunteerism and your support, anything's possible, but the potential of this station is enormous because we do have a democratic institution here, and it's guided by its membership. And so, therefore, I would just advise people that this is an incredibly unique and valuable institution and needs your support. So please do pick up the phone this week and make a pledge. Right now, there's nobody standing by to take your calls this evening. But during the course of the week, as you're listening to the station, the shows you like, the shows you don't like, you know how that goes. But do call in and support WPKN. We are going momentarily to Democracy Now!, so do stay tuned in case you're still not up on the new schedule. Democracy Now! Here is heard here every week night, Monday through Friday, between 10 and 11 p.m., and that's followed by Free Speech Radio News, which goes from 11 to 11:30 p.m. replacing its 6 p.m. Old broadcast time. So it's now, instead of 6 p.m., it's 11 p.m. weeknights. That's Free Speech Radio News. But right now, I thank you for listening and remind you that this is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM, WPKN in Montauk at 88.7 FM, and our website is WPKN.org. So if you feel so moved and don't want to wait to make a phone call, you can make a secure online contribution there right now as we speak, WPKN.org. Right now, stay tuned for Democracy Now!
We ask the Pakistani government not to delay any longer in the apprehension of the main elements in this terrorist attack.
Iran's president accuses Pakistan of involvement in Sunday's suicide bombing that killed 42 people, including six Revolutionary Guard commanders. Other Iranian officials are blaming the United States. We'll get the latest. Then the Hispanic Caucus calls for the immediate termination of the controversial 287G program that delegates some federal immigration enforcement authority to state and local agencies. We'll host a debate. And the government of the Maldives holds a special cabinet session underwater to dramatize climate change. We'll hear from President Mohamed Nasheed.
If it was important for countries to defend Poland in the 1930s because it was a frontline state, it's very important to take care of the Maldives now, because the Maldives and many other small states are in the front line of what is happening to the world, to climate today.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iran, six senior commanders and the country's elite Revolutionary Guard were assassinated Sunday in a suicide bombing that killed as many as 36 others. The bombing occurred in the southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan near the Pakistani border. It's been described as the most serious attack against Iran in more than 20 years. The Sunni militant group Jundallah claimed responsibility for the attack. The head of Iran's Revolutionary Guard has vowed to retaliate against the United States and Britain after accusing them of backing Jundallah. Meanwhile, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad accused Pakistan of also having links to the bombers.
We ask the Pakistani government not to delay any longer in the apprehension of the main elements in this terrorist attack. And also, we were informed that some security agents in Pakistan are cooperating with the main elements of this terrorist incident, and we regard it as our right to demand these criminals.
We'll have more on Iran after headlines. In other news from the region, the Pakistani military has launched a major offensive against militants in South Waziristan, the heartland of the Pakistani Taliban. Over 150,000 civilians have fled the region seeking refuge. The Obama administration had been urging Pakistan to wage the assault. General David Petraeus, the head of the U.S. Central Command, arrived in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, Sunday to consult with Pakistan's civilian and military leaders. Investigative reporter Jane Mayer of The New Yorker magazine reveals the number of U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan has risen dramatically since President Obama took office. During his first 9.5 months in office, Obama authorized as many CIA aerial attacks in Pakistan as President Bush did in his final 3 years in office. At any time, the CIA now has multiple drones flying over Pakistan scouting for targets. Mayer writes, quote, "There is no longer any doubt that targeted killing has become official U.S. policy." David Kilcullen, a former advisor to General Petraeus, says the propaganda costs of drone attacks on civilians have been disastrously high. He recently wrote, quote, "Every one of these dead non-combatants represents an alienated family, a new revenge feud, and more recruits for a militant movement that's grown exponentially, even as drone strikes have increased." The Afghan electoral crisis intensified today as Afghan election officials refused to accept findings of a UN-backed investigative panel that would force a runoff. The UN panel determined allegedly fraudulent ballots reduced President Hamid Karzai's portion of the vote to about 47%, less than the 50% threshold needed to avoid a runoff. But the Afghan Independent Election Commission, which is dominated by Karzai allies, has rejected the UN data. It's unclear what will happen if the Election Commission continues to reject the UN findings. Afghan law says the UN-backed panel is the final arbiter on complaints, but the Afghan Election Commission maintains it can contest at least parts of the investigation. The election dispute may play a critical role in the Obama administration's decision-making process on whether to send more troops to Afghanistan. John Kerry, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, addressed the issue in an interview with CNN.
It would be entirely irresponsible for the President of the United States to commit more troops to this country when we don't even have an election finished and know who the president is and what kind of government we're working with. And when our own commanding general tells us that a critical component of achieving our mission here is, in fact, good governance, and we're living with a government that we know has to change and provide it, how could the president responsibly say, oh, they asked for more? Sure, here they are. And we know that the two critical stools of counterinsurgency aren't going to stand. That would be irresponsible for a president of the United States.
The New York Times has begun publishing a five-part series by its correspondent, David Rhodes, who was held as a hostage by the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan for 7 months. In his piece, Rhodes says that Washington's anti-terrorism policy has galvanized the Taliban. He writes, quote, commanders fixated on the deaths of Afghan, Iraqi, and Palestinian civilians in military airstrikes, as well as the American detention of Muslim prisoners who had been held for years without being charged. In economic news, the House Financial Services Committee has agreed to weaken the power of the proposed Consumer Financial Protection Agency by exempting 98% of the nation's banks from oversight by the agency. The agreement prevents the new agency from conducting annual examinations of the lending practices at more than 8,000 of the nation's 8,200 banks, leaving only the largest banks and other lenders subject to the agency's examiners. Another former Goldman Sachs executive has been tapped for a top post in the Obama administration. The Securities and Exchange Commission has named 29-year-old Adam Storch as the agency's first ever chief operating officer of the Enforcement Division. For the past 5 years, Storch worked at Goldman Sachs, most recently as vice president in Goldman's Business Intelligence Group. Support is growing in Capitol Hill to repeal a 1945 law that exempts the health insurance industry from antitrust laws. The House Judiciary Committee plans to vote on the matter on Wednesday. The chair of the committee, John Conyers, said it does not make sense anymore to exempt the industry from federal antitrust exemption. In his weekly radio address, President Obama said lawmakers were right to review the measure.
The fact is, the insurance industry is making this last-ditch effort to stop reform, even as costs continue to rise and our health care dollars continue to be poured into their profits, bonuses, and administrative costs that do nothing to make us healthy, that often actually go toward figuring out how to avoid covering people. And they're earning these profits and bonuses while enjoying a privileged exception from our antitrust laws, a matter that Congress is rightfully reviewing.
In other healthcare news, White House support for the creation of a government-run public health insurance program appears to be deteriorating. Senior White House advisor Valerie Jarrett said Obama still thinks it's the best possible choice, but she admitted the president's not demanding that it be included in the final legislation considered by Congress. The former top procurement official in President Bush's administration has been sentenced to a year in prison for lying about his ties to Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. David Safavian was convicted in December of concealing his efforts to help Abramoff win government contracts. Safavian served as chief of staff at the General Services Administration. The UN Human Rights Council has endorsed a UN report that accused Israel of war crimes in Gaza. In a special session, 25 states endorsed the resolution. Six, including the United States, voted against it, and 11 abstained. The report by South African jurist Richard Goldstone accuses both Israel and Hamas of war crimes in Gaza, but is most critical of Israel. Around 1,400 Palestinians were killed in the Israeli attack, most of them civilians. This is U.S. Ambassador Douglas Griffiths.
the United States continues to focus our attention on our main goal, working with Israel and the Palestinian Authority to relaunch successful permanent status negotiations as soon as possible. Resolutions like the one before us today can only exacerbate polarization and divisiveness.
A United Nations investigation into recent explosions in South Lebanon have indicated Israel had planted spy devices on Lebanese land in violation of a ceasefire agreement. It appears the spy devices were detonated by remote control from Israel after their discovery by Lebanese security forces. A first explosion was reported Saturday evening.